OA1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, you will hear stories from Dan Novak and Jill Robbins. Later, Brian Lynn presents this week's technology report. We close with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dan Novak.
Facebook says it has identified and stopped hundreds of fake accounts on its website. The company said accounts spread Russian propaganda about the invasion of Ukraine throughout Western Europe. Facebook parent company Meta said the network created more than 60 websites that looked like the websites of real news organizations. The false websites included one similar to The Guardian in Britain and Germany's Der Spiegel. But the false news sites repeated talking points used by Russian officials about Ukraine. Meta said it stopped the operation before it was able to gain a large audience. However, Facebook said it was the largest and most complex Russian propaganda effort that it has found since the invasion began. More than 1,600 false Facebook accounts were used to spread propaganda to people in Germany, Italy, France, Britain, and Ukraine. Video: false staging in Bucha revealed, claimed one of the fake news stories. The story blamed Ukraine for the killings of hundreds of Ukrainians in a town occupied by the Russians. The false social media accounts were used to spread links to the fake news stories and other pro-Russian posts and videos. The network was active throughout the summer. On a few occasions, the operation's content was amplified by the official Facebook pages of Russian embassies in Europe and Asia, said David Agronovich. He is Meta's director of threat disruption. I think this is probably the largest and most complex Russian origin operation that we've disrupted since the beginning of the war in Ukraine earlier this year. The network's activities were first noticed by reporters in Germany. When Meta began its investigation, it found that many of the false accounts had already been removed by Facebook's automated systems. Thousands of people were following the network's Facebook pages when they were deactivated earlier this year. Researchers said they could not directly connect the network to the Russian government. But they noted that the operation was complex, using several languages, and carefully created false websites. Since the war began in February, Russia has used online disinformation and conspiracy theories to weaken international support for Ukraine. Groups linked to the Russian government have accused Ukraine of starting attacks. They have also claimed the war began because of U.S. weapon development and have called Ukrainian refugees criminals and rapists. A message sent to the Russian embassy in Washington, D.C., asking for a response to Meta's recent actions, was not immediately returned. Researchers at Meta also found a smaller network based in China. It also attempted to spread political content in the U.S. The operation reached a small U.S. audience, with some posts receiving just a single engagement. Many had simple English language mistakes, for example. Meta said the network is notable because it is the first to target Americans with political messages before this year's midterm elections. The Chinese posts did not support one party, but were aimed at issues that cause political division. One account commented on a Facebook post by Republican Senator Marco Rubio. It asked him to stop gun violence using the hashtag RubioChildrenKiller. Ben Nemo is the head of threat intelligence for Meta. Essentially, the message was America bad, China good, he said. While it failed, it's important because it's a new direction for Chinese disinformation operations, he said. I'm Dan Novak.
Esteban Sinisterra is a young black clothing designer from Colombia's largely poor Pacific area. He now designs clothes for Colombia's vice president, Francia Márquez, the first Afro-Colombian woman to hold the position. Sinisterra calls it resistance fashion, and his colorful designs for Márquez have since drawn international attention. Sinisterra grew up in the town of Santa Barbara Iscuande in the Nariño area. He says many young people there have few opportunities to escape involvement in the ongoing conflict in the country. His background is not very different from that of Márquez. The vice president is a former housekeeper and environmental activist. She grew up in the poor town of Suarez in Cuaca. Because she opposed gold mining, she faced death threats. In one way or another, her history and my history are similar, so I think there was a very lovely spark there, said the 23-year-old Sinisterra. He now lives in the city of Cali and studies social work in addition to his job as a designer. Sinisterra learned to make clothes from his aunt and grandmother. Describing his similarities with the vice president, he said, "First, we accept and recognize that we have roots that connect us, which is Africa. But taking into account those roots, we also express the territory where we're from, the Colombian Pacific." "The clothes make you think of those roots," Sinisterra said. "It is being able to show that this is who we are. So for me, fashion, my fashion, is resistance." I'm Jill Robbins.
Scientists have developed a technology-powered mapping tool to prevent ships from hitting whales in areas off America's west coast. The system is called WhaleSafe. It uses equipment placed in the ocean to identify the presence of whales in the surrounding area. The tool also records shipping activity and ship speeds. The collected data is then sent by satellite to scientists who examine it and seek to provide guidance to ship operators. Developers of the system say it produces near real-time information about nearby whale movements. Whales Safe has already been operating near ports in Southern California. It was recently launched to the north in San Francisco Bay. There is a problem in the bay with ships hitting whales. Last month, wildlife officials reported the latest suspected case. A humpback whale washed ashore in the San Francisco Bay with injuries suggesting the animal was killed in a ship strike. The Marine Mammal Center near San Francisco said it was the fifth whale to be killed by a ship strike in the area this year. Wildlife officials note that the actual number of whales killed by ships is likely much higher because the bodies of the dead animals are rarely discovered. Humpback whales visit California to feed in the summer and autumn before migrating south to reproduce off the coast of Mexico. They are among the world's most endangered whales. An estimated 35,000 to 40,000 remain in the wild. The Marine Mammal Center says the main threats facing humpback whales are strikes from ships and getting caught in fishing and waste equipment. The Whale Safe system is designed to identify and protect several different species, including humpback, blue, fin, and gray whales. It uses three methods to do so. First, it uses flotation devices, known as buoys, to record sounds the whales make. Second, it uses computer models to process current and historical ocean data to predict where the whales are most likely to be. Third, it permits trained observers and citizens to report whale sightings through a mobile app. The Whale Safe project is supported by the Marine Mammal Center and the Benioff Ocean Science Laboratory at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Other organizations and government agencies also cooperate on the project. Developers of the system say the expansion of Whale Safe to San Francisco demonstrates that the system can be effectively deployed to additional areas of the United States and the world. Officials from the Marine Mammal Center say they have plans to expand the system to other areas where whales face a high risk of being hit by ships. These areas include parts of the U.S. Eastern Seaboard. Worldwide, such areas include waters near Sri Lanka, Chile, Greece, and Spain's Canary Islands. Jeff Boom is a leader of the Marine Mammal Center. He said the Whale Safe system combines the latest technology with thoughtful conservation efforts to create a solution to reduce risk to whales. Boom added, "This is where tech meets Mother Nature for the benefit of marine life." Douglas McCauley is director of the Benioff Ocean Science Laboratory. He said in a statement that the killing of whales by ship strikes is an avoidable problem. "We can't any longer be passive observers of endangered whales washing ashore along San Francisco's beaches," McCauley said. He added, "Whale Safe is an exciting coming together of marine scientists, technologists, conservation organizations, business leaders, and government partners to do something about this issue." I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In May of 1787, a group of America's early leaders met in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to amend the Articles of Confederation. That document established a loose union of the 13 states. Instead, the leaders wrote a completely new constitution. They created America's system of government and recognized the rights of its citizens. Last week, we discussed the way the delegates agreed that states would be represented in the national government. There would be two houses in the legislature. In one house, the House of Representatives, the number of representatives from each state would depend on the state's population. In the other house, the Senate, all states would have an equal number of representatives. The agreement on representation was known as the Great Compromise. Not all the delegates in Philadelphia were pleased with it, but it saved the convention from failure. The debate on representation in the House raised an important issue. No one wanted to talk about it, but all the delegates knew they had to discuss it. The issue was slavery. There were thousands of slaves in the United States in 1787. Most of them were in southern states. But there were many slaves in the north, too. And northern ship owners made a lot of money by importing slaves from Africa. A modern-day Supreme Court Justice, Clarence Thomas, came from a family whose ancestors included slaves. Justice Thomas says slavery made no sense in America.
How can you have a free country with slaves? We understood that. It's a contradiction. It contradicts the very founding premise of the country.
The Articles of Confederation said nothing about slavery. Each state could decide to allow it or not. Massachusetts, for example, made slavery illegal. 9 other states stopped importing new slaves. Only 3 states, Georgia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, continued to import slaves. The issue was never easy to discuss. Some of the most important men in America, including George Washington and James Madison, owned slaves. No one wanted to insult these men. Yet the delegates at the convention had to make some decisions about slavery. Slavery affected laws on trade and taxes, as well as the question of representation in Congress. If the number of representatives in the House was based on a state's population, who would you count? Would you count just free people, or would you count slaves too? Akhil Reed Amar, a professor of law and political science at Yale University, calls slavery the original sin of America's founders.
They inherited it, to be sure, and they worried about it, but not enough.
During the debate, some delegates argued that slaves were property and should not be counted for purposes of representation. Others argued that slaves were people and should be counted with everyone else. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania made an angry speech. He denounced slavery as an evil institution. Charles Pinckney of South Carolina defended the existence of slavery in the United States. In all ages, he said, one half of mankind have been slaves. George Mason of Virginia, a slave owner, wanted to free all slaves. He said Virginia attempted to do that when it was a British colony, but that the British government refused. He blamed the problem on British businessmen who made money from slavery. Other delegates rose to denounce or defend slavery, but no one at the convention had the power to rule on whether slavery was right or wrong. Everyone knew the convention would fail if they tried to write a constitution that banned slavery. The southern states would never accept it. They would refuse to be part of the United States. Rufus King of Massachusetts said, "The convention should consider slavery only as a political matter." And that was what happened. The delegates accepted several political compromises on the issue. James Wilson of Pennsylvania, for example, proposed a method of counting each state's population for purposes of representation. All white people and other free citizens would be counted as one person each. Every five slaves would be counted only as three people. This was called the three-fifths rule. The delegates accepted it. The word slave was never used in the Constitution. The document simply used the words all other persons. The three-fifths rule remained the law until the 14th Amendment to the Constitution came into effect in 1868. Alexander Hamilton said the three-fifths compromise was necessary. Without it, he said, no union could possibly have been formed. Slavery also became an issue when the delegates began discussing the powers of the national legislature. Once again, the delegates asked, are slaves people, or are they property? The answer would affect import taxes and the growth of new states. The delegates accepted several compromises on these questions, too. They agreed that the Treasury could collect a tax of $10 for every imported slave. They also agreed that slaves could be imported until 1808. Then, no new slaves could be brought into the country. Until then, each state had the power to make its own decisions about slavery. After 1808, the national government would make all the decisions. Constitutional law professor Akhil Reed Amar says that agreement is where the delegates went wrong.
What was the founders' biggest mistake? Not that they didn't get rid of slavery immediately. It was already a part of their world. It would have been difficult to get rid of slavery immediately. But what they didn't do is come up with a long-term plan to get rid of slavery eventually.
Debate on the Constitution continued through the summer of 1787. At the same time, some of the delegates raised an important question. Once the document was written, who would approve it? The state legislatures? The people? Or, as Governor Morris proposed, one big national convention? Elbridge Gerry opposed giving that power to the people. The people, he said, have the wildest ideas of government in the world. James Madison disagreed. He believed the people must ratify their new plan of government. Madison considered the difference between a system founded on the legislatures only and one founded on the people to be the true difference between a league or treaty and a constitution. When the debate was over, the delegates agreed that the people should ratify the new constitution through conventions held in each state. Justice Clarence Thomas and law professor Akhil Reed Amar have described this agreement as one of the most remarkable parts of the convention.
You think of the going to Washington and trying to get him to leave Mount Vernon, and he doesn't want to leave because he's finally back home. He'd been away over 4 years, and he didn't want to leave. And he goes to Philadelphia, and they do it. They come up with this document with 4 months, and now you have it. It's going to the Congress, and it's going to be sent to the people, too.
To the people.
To the people, amazing. To ratify.
Amazing.
Finally, the delegates had to decide how many yes votes by states would be needed to ratify the Constitution. Any changes to the Articles of Confederation needed ratification by all 13 states. The Philadelphia Convention was called only to change those articles, not to replace them. So all 13 states would have to approve. But several delegates said this would be impossible. After all, Rhode Island never sent a representative to Philadelphia. That state was sure to reject the Constitution. Also, as everyone knew, the Philadelphia Convention went far past the point of changing the Articles of Confederation. The delegates wrote a completely new plan of government. But that meant they could agree to accept ratification by fewer than 13 states. Delegates who supported a strong central government wanted to quickly put the question to a vote. How many states were needed to ratify? By the end of the day, the convention had not decided. But early the next day, the delegates voted, and the number they agreed on was 9. The convention in Philadelphia was nearing the end of its work. The delegates needed only to write out their agreements in final form and sign the document.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.